Yes.
It says which the following, or during the follicular phase of the ovarian menstrual cycle, is it estrogen and progesterone levels are elevated?
Okay, so it had to do with the follicular phase during the estrous cycle. That's endocrine. What's elevated? Let's go to the endocrine one. So here we go. So we're dealing with the follicular phase, and you see right here, the follicular phase estrogen is the highest, right? And then if we start to think about the luteal phase, we have both estrogen and progesterone raised. So this can be a little complicated, but remember chorionic and adiotropin, endometrium, you know, secreting that, and that basically keeps the corpus luteum going. And then what's different sometimes on the old exams, I think, might be even the next question, depends on what year you are. Corpus luteum during pregnancy versus the normal menstrual cycle. But in pregnancy, the corpus luteum becomes so enlarged and maintained, it secretes both progesterone and estrogen at higher levels, right, during pregnancy implantation. But during the normal estrous cycle, it's just pretty much progesterone. Okay?
Connected to the endocrine?
The endocrine chapter.
For
follicular phase, pretty much. Estrogen during the follicular phase, right? Estrogen right here. And luteal phase, both estrogen and progesterone. More burning questions? Have we looked at old exams yet? Didn't have time? You're going to cram Wednesday night, right? It's too much to cram on Wednesday night. Too much to cram on Wednesday night. I'm just letting you know. Do not stay up all night. You can't think clearly. Multiple choice test, I think some of you are going to finish out there in 35 minutes. If you know the stuff, it's going to go fast. I'm going to try to make a few short answer questions, you know, and probably more points than 100, maybe like 104, 106 points or something, right? So that's your bonus, basically, or the curve. So you want to do, you know, all the questions, right? But the problem is if we just put 50 questions, yeah, you could finish quicker, but then everyone's 2 points, it adds up pretty quick. You miss two of them, that's 4 points, right? You miss three of them, they're 6 points. You already miss four and you're already, wow, stressing, right? So this is the idea, to put some extra questions in there, but it makes it a little longer. But most likely if you know the answers, it's, you know, these kind of things. But the problem is, if you just look at old exams and you kind of memorize the answer without knowing the concept, just change the wording. And if you've looked at different questions, old exams, it might look like the same question, but there's been a change in the wording, right? And it's a different answer, right? So watch out for that. No burning questions? Haven't had time to look at the old ones yet? Okay.
It says, which hormone is involved in the milk ejection reflex during nursing mammals? Is that the lactin or oxytocin?
So in nursing with mammals for milk ejection is oxytocin. Milk production is prolactin, right? So mostly oxytocin is uterine contractions and milk letdown, right? Yeah, and production with prolactin. So if you hear a baby crying and if you're breastfeeding, sometimes you have milk letdown, and that's a stimulation, auditory stimulation. Kind of interesting. What else is interesting about oxytocin that we talked about? Behaviorally, people do these experiments with mice and things like that, humans as well. No one wants to see it. The bonding hormone. It's the bonding hormone, right? And so, actually, this is partly kind of interesting, too, because mothers that do breastfeed, they think that actually helps with bonding of the mother with the fetus, with the baby, the infant, and that enhances that bonding. And it's been shown in rodent models where they, like I mentioned in class, right, you inject the female with oxytocin when you're pairing it with a male, for example, versus you pair that with a male when you didn't inject oxytocin, they're more responsive to the male when they had the oxytocin in the female. So it's called the bonding hormone. And it might even have to do with relationships with males and females are, you know, partners as well.
Another question, it says the surge in the luteinizing hormone on day 14 of the menstrual cycle, mm-hmm. would that be caused by both estrogen and progesterone? Or
so during the luteal cycle,
yeah.
the surge in progesterone is due to the corpus luteum? What was the...
It's number 35.
The surge in luteinizing hormone on day 14... Where's luteinizing hormone? Yeah, that peak. That's the ovulation. It depends on some of those were Brent Palmer's types of questions too from before, but this is really quite interesting. It's really due to some of the estrogen aspects. Estrogen stimulating LH because it's a feedback process. It actually stimulates a bit of that. I know progesterone is really not high until later in the follicular, in the luteal phase. All right, so that's where that comes in.
So A.
Yes, I would choose A in that. All right.
Hey, how's it going?
You're wild.
Oh, fantastic! You can take. And so you sometimes do this group.
Sometimes, yeah.
Oh, okay. Group section one.
No, I've been not one.
Another question. You have another one?
Oh, no. I was just looking.
And I tried to make those. So if you go back to the real questions, when Brent Palmer had them, he was very specific about even which, like the synthesis of some of these hormones. We're not going to go through those synthesis of the details, but what do we want to know about steroid hormones generally? Cholesterol, in that, you know, you go through these different ones like the androgens and then the... estrogen types, so you actually go through testosterone to make some of these estrogen-like compounds too, right? Another burning question? Burning questions? No? Yes?
Is there a document with the basic big ideas that we need, like the basic ideas we need to know for this experience? That would help me out.
Like a study guide?
Yeah, because there's so much content, I would just like to know the big points that you need to know, like... know this diagram, know this system, things like that.
Yes, that would help me. That would be very good. No, we didn't make a one-by-one kind of list of the main points because
right.
there's so many that it's basically
right.
like the whole thing.
Right.
But so what to do? My view, what to do is to do something like this. Go through the beginning. What was the beginning? Where did we start with this chapter? Sensory or was it behavior?
Sensory.
I would go through the sensory PowerPoints. I would go to PowerPoint 1 and I would start clicking through them. And I would, let's see, I would say, do I understand the general take home of these kind of, you know, what was the main thing that we covered in class, right? And we talked about proprioceptors more than we've talked about lots of things. We talked about muscle spindles, right? We've talked about that Pinocchio nose experiment that we tried to do, right? With the vibration of the arm. And, you know, those kind of things. Did we, what was some of the main things that we did when we went to the outreach center, right? We did the blind spot. We did these optical illusions. We talked about pushing on the side of the eye. And what's the main point of that, you know? That you can mechanically stimulate that, but why do you see light? Why do you see light is because those are hardwired neurons. You activate that neuron, that goes to that part of the brain that then stimulates that part, right? So those are the kind of things. We know about receptor potentials in the sensory endings. What do they do to it? Like if you touch on your skin, how do you get that receptor potential? What does that do to it? What's that do to it? If you touch your skin, how do you activate the sensory ending? Exactly. Stretch-activated ion channels. So you see the idea? This is the way I would go through every PowerPoint and just kind of go through the main things that we talked about. Transmitters, generally small molecules. They're not going to be big molecules. They're not going to be big proteins that, you know, have to go fast for chemical transmission, right? Small, usually amino acid-based molecules. Right, and we talked about graded potentials, and then how do you get that action potential? That's test one generally. But transmission, rapid and ones that can maintain the firing, You know, the stimulus, why do we get accommodation? Why do they stop firing? Well, it could be an accessory protein around it, or maybe it's like that onion layers that we talk about, the Purcinian corpuscle, right? That those layers no longer maintain that mechanical transformation on the sensory ending. So those are the kind of things I would go through and understand, you know, tonic, phasic, responses, accommodation that we talked about. Just if you don't know the answer, you write crayfish, don't drink. All right, and we talked about the muscle receptor organ, you know, basically like your muscle spindle, right? And you get different responses. People have worked on this. It's a similar aspect in your muscles, how you detect proprioception. You have ones for static position. You have ones for dynamic position, right? Just like in there. So as an example, I would go through like this PowerPoint and look at what are these differences? Why can our retina see so well on edges, right? And where was this kind of worked out? The horseshoe crab, lateral inhibition to give the highest stimulation where the responses are coming in, right? And this can happen right in your retina. It's like a little nervous system itself. We talked about the Purcinian corpuscle. Most of all these, like hairs, you know, movement. You can take a single hair in your arm and move it back and forth. Mechanical transduction, stretch-activated ion channels. We've talked about some interesting examples, like detecting gravity sense and this lobster we talked about, the statocyst. But what is it for our ears, for our equilibrium and static position? What do we do? For static position, how do you know your head's up right now? You're standing up. What's the general idea? Are you moving your semicircular canals? No. Is it the cochlear? Is it a snail-like structure that's doing this? Remember how we told you to remember what the snail-like structure does? You know, the snail, the horn, looks like a snail shell. That's the thing to think about hearing. What is it in our ear, inner ear? Do you remember? The two stone-like structures that are like the statocyst. The utriculus and sacculus, right? And so in our ear, we have the reticulus. Let's go to it. Yeah. Somewhere here. Oh, we brought it up. Where did it go to? It's coming up, I think. Or we talked about it in one of these figures. We have the utriculus and sacculus. These are regions where we actually have like a statolith organ. It's just like the lobster, no different. It sits on top of a mucous membrane. And it actually is sensing gravity. So if you hold your head sideways, that's what you detect. I mentioned the basketball player that had a problem that hit their head here, UK, right? And then their otolith came loose, and they actually couldn't see straight, can't read, can't do things right, couldn't drive for a while because they had nystagmus in their eyes. Okay, so I would go through these and figure out, you know, like the main points. Like, what do the semicircular canals do? What does the utriculus sacculus do? What does the cochlear do, right, for hearing? We've talked about these little ampulla-like structures, similar in fish. Well, for the lateral line, it's the same general structure of this modified hair cell. Remember, this is the fingers coming out of a single cell that have, like, these stericilla and echinocilla. Then it bends this way or that way. Can activate that cell. But you have these throughout your semicircular canals, and these same modified hair cells actually allow you to hear too, so know what these general structures do in equilibrium for semicircular canals. Here's that otoliths, the stone that's on the top, and just like the lobster, you know, it sits on this gelatin mass. It either bends this way or that way, depending on gravity, right? So again, kind of the general flow. We've talked about, you know, transduction of that sound, right? Mechanical transduction through the Malasinski stapes, to then movement of a fluid. That movement of the fluid then causes the fluid around the cochlea to then move. And then it can move the membranes that are in there. I didn't want you to have to know all that anatomy, but basically this pectoral membrane can move back and forth. And if you have hair cells that are on that membrane, it either deflects them one way or the other. And so that can detect sound. And that sound varies on how that's going to move that membrane along that snail-like structure. Because right there, they're attached to those hair-like structures right there, those hair cells. And they're going to deflect those hair cells based on the sound wave that goes through the fluid. And it goes in that circle, what we talked about. It goes in the circle through the oval window, and then back around, and then out the round window. It's not the fluid goes out, it's but the sound wave, the pressure wave in the fluid. All right. So, kind of just going through this process. It's kind of neat. You know, the general point. Some of this is just kind of gee-whizzy. Okay, I remember that. But some things are more detailed, right? Like taste, what did we have to know about taste? What did we tell you about taste with all these? Anybody remember? The main points. We've got lots of different taste receptors, right? And what do they work through? Ion channels. Are they all being inhibited or mostly being excited? Are they all working through second messengers? No. It's kind of a mix. Depends on which types. I didn't want you to memorize which one does what. But the idea is, you know, how do they work in general, right? Usually allowing some flow of ions across the cell membrane, could be activating second messengers, but the idea is that they usually excite the cell. Some of them actually could inhibit or block, but generally they're excitatory. We talked about smell a bit. Not too much about that, but the idea is that they project to a particular part of the brain. We talked more about the eye, not so much on the comparative aspect, but we did talk about insect eyes or what's the individual structure for an insect eye. What do we call that individual unit in an insect eye? Starts with an O.
Omatidia.
Going once. Yeah, omatidia, right? And in the primary structures in the vertebrate eye are the rods and cones. What do the rods detect? Black and white, pretty much, for white light. The cones, C for color, right? Red, blue, green. What's the main difference between the insect eye and the vertebrate eye in the sense of the primary structures? The omatidia, the primary cells that detect the light, do they depolarize or hyperpolarize? The primary structures in the insect eye. Depolarize. In the mammalian eye, rods and cones do what when light hits it? Hyperpolarize. Due to what? Well, due to a particular type of channel. Sodium channel doing what? Closing. Right. So if you close the sodium channel, it's no longer depolarized. Then it starts to go back down to a hyperpolarized state where potassium equilibrium is. So what do we call that current in the dark? When you're not stimulating it, we call it the dark current due to sodium, right? Sodium is due to the dark current. So that's the way to go through this PowerPoint. This is to kind of think about the main points that we've talked about. And, you know, we didn't really worry about that so much, right? And I usually tell you at the time, like, hey, we're not going to have to worry about that. But, you know that the cornea changes, but we did talk a little bit about this, right? Light comes through those cells, hits the rods and cones, then goes through this process. Integration goes on, lateral inhibition. We talked about the blind spot, right, in the eye. It's where the optic nerve leaves the retina. Right, you can see this. It's pretty cool. Pigments detect that light, and we just talked about this right now, the dark and current, for example, and how you detect light, and the differences of rods and cones, and color, and we didn't worry about this so much. We didn't worry about the anatomy. I told you we didn't have to worry about the anatomy, but the occipital cortex in the back is where you detect or integrate for vision. All right, and we didn't really worry about that. So when you go through these PowerPoints, you know, like, hey, yeah, that wasn't a big thing. The only thing we really talked about the horseshoe crab was this is where they worked out these individual recordings to look at lateral inhibition and then understood how that works in a mammalian eye. So pretty cool. Thermal receptors, we talked about like rattlesnake roundup, great old hometown craziness. talked a little bit about pain, didn't we? You know, we talked sometimes about pain, and that some people were working in pain labs here with Brad Taylor. And how do you detect pain, and how do you modulate pain, right? Prostaglandins, like we just talked about prostaglandins with indomethacin, right? For people might have pain or a pregnant mother, and so they take indomethacin to try to reduce maybe pain or even joint pain or something, or they got pain from swelling of their joints, and now they're affecting the what blood vessel are they affecting? The ductus arteriosus, right? So see how it all kind of comes back, integrating everything. Substance P is the transmitter that activates the pain pathway, and so where do you modulate pain? Right? What do you make? What's the runner's high due to? Like when you get a kind of, you always have to keep running all the time. If you're exercise and you don't run, you don't feel good, right? And what do people take to modulate pain? What kind of drugs do they take? Pain meds or something else people are addicted to these days. You know, not great, right? Analgesics, but some of these kind of endogenous opioids, dynorphin, right, is a big one. Endorphins are endogenous morphine, is basically what this is, endogenous morphine, right, and how does it actually work? So you could take morphine, but it hits these opioid receptors. This is a big problem that people are addicted to today, right? And so this is part of the national crisis that we're having also. So where do these work? You know, they modulate the substance P that's released, and so you don't detect it. So that's kind of neat to think about. We talked about a little bit of the lateral line in fish that detect their lateral, the current around them. They can generate that electric organ. We have magnetoreceptors like migratory pigeons, right? They can detect the magnetic earth fields. So this is the way I would go through each of the PowerPoints. Right, so we could do that, but you get, I would pull up all your PowerPoints, and you got sensory, you got behavior, then what did we cover? Muscle, and circulation, and now, well, we just finished that, and endocrine, right? And the endocrine is like, right, tremendous amount of stuff. I'm not a big favor of the endocrine, but there's a lot of things to remember about it. The reason I don't like it so much is there's a lot to memorize. I hate the memorizing. But there's a lot of integration with endocrine and circulatory and when we get to the renal system. So it's kind of neat when you start to integrate it with the other systems. Okay. Which ones do you feel most stressed about? Not sure. Everything. But see what we just did? We went through this, and so... You know, that's the kind of the way to go through each PowerPoint, right? And when you start to do that, you're going to find out you're going to have to maybe slow down on the endocrine a little bit. And on the skeletal muscle, what do you have to do? You're going to take a blank piece of paper, and what are we going to do? Well, on the skeletal muscle, you could think about skeletal to neuromuscular junction to activation. So let's think about it. What happens? You're talking to yourself. I want to move my arm, right? So you thought about it. Activated something up here in your motor cortex, right? Which is the shape of your body on the motor cortex, which is called what's that called? The homunculus, right? Right, so that I'm going to move my arm, and so you activate that part of your brain, goes down your spinal cord, hits alpha motor neurons, right? Alpha motor neurons, fires, and then that goes down to your muscle. So what happens at the nerve terminal? Release of what type of transmitter? Acetylcholine, right? Acetylcholine is released. What does it do? What kind of receptors are on your skeletal muscle? Nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. They open up. They allow sodium to go in, potassium to come out. The depolarize is kind of created. But if you have enough of them, it reaches a threshold on your skeletal muscles, activates an action potential. Boom! Action potential travels down the muscle. Where does it go? We're talking about big mammal, big muscle fibers. Goes down the goes down the T-tubule, right? Down the T-tubule. What does it activate? What type of protein in the T-tubule to relate to the intracellular stores does it activate? What's that protein called? dihydropyridine receptors, right? Dihydropyridine receptors, they cause a conformational change. They're linked inside the cell to what other protein that's on attached to the SCR? Ranitidine receptors. Pulls the plug out of the bathtub. The bathtub is your SCR, right? Dumps calcium out. What does that calcium bind to? What does calcium bind to? Inside this troponin what?
C.
Troponin C causes a conformational change, exposes the active site. The myosin head's waiting for that active site. As soon as it can find it, boom, attaches, ratchets. What causes the myosin head to come back off? ATP comes off. It's ratcheted back, waiting to bind to the next active site that's still exposed. But what could cause that active site to disappear? What made it appear? It made it appear because the active sites was there because the troponins moved out of the way. But if they move back, how would they move back to that spot and hide it? If calcium goes away, right? So if calcium gets sucked back up into the SCR, then the troponin C is not binding calcium, so then a conformational change hides that active site. So then it can't bind, muscle can relapse, right? That rate of moving depends on how fast you can actually move, like we talked about. Both fish, shake a muscle, things like that, right? Okay, so when you talk about like that whole process, this is what we should know, you know, going through that. Then you think about the muscle itself. What should we know? We should draw out. How many sarcomeres do we need to draw out? To get your banding pattern right? Three sarcomeres. Draw three sarcomeres. And then label A band, I band, F band. No, that should make you question something. Practicing if you're awake. You know, draw out the I band, A band. Does the A band shorten the muscle contraction in general? Mammalian skeletal muscle, does the A band shorten with muscle contraction? What's the A band? Respond to. These are the things that you just got to snap with. Alright? But if you're not snapping, if you stayed up all night and tried to cram, you're going to be deliriously tired Thursday morning, and then you can't think straight. So the thing is, you don't want to cram Thursday night. You want to study ahead of time. I know it's hard, but it's part of it. Yeah. So draw out your sarcomeres, kind of know what's happening, which ones are shortening, which ones aren't, in general, for mammalian skeletal muscle. What else do we have to know about muscle? We have to know about the different types of muscle. We just talked about cardiac earlier, skeletal, and smooth muscle. What's different about these? What's one of the major differences between these that you can remember? Remember that table? Involuntary, involuntary, right, that's good. Some other major factors. Striated and unstriated. Now, is cardiac striated or unstriated? It's striated, right? You can see sarcomeres in cardiac. What's not striated? Smooth. Does it still work with myosin actin? Right? But you just don't see the striations. Calcium, where does calcium come from in skeletal muscle in general? From mammals. We just went through the sarcoplasmic reticulum. How about cardiac and smooth muscle? Yeah, ECF as well as sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Okay, so what else? What's on that part? We talked a little bit about development, but not too much. Does muscle single nucleated or multi nucleated skeletal muscle? Multi nucleated? Because a lot of different cells fuse together to make your skeletal muscle. It's really quite cool because the nuclei underneath the neuromuscular junction actually produce different proteins than nuclei out on the sides of the muscle. That's pretty neat when you think about local regulation of protein synthesis and stuff. But we didn't go into a lot of depth. We do offer a whole muscle course just in skeletal muscle. Isn't that great? I know. It's through HHS. Burning questions. So, kind of go through this. You know, that was muscle. There's other things that we didn't cover. And behavior, we covered some of the behavior aspects and different sensory we just went through. circulatory, there's a lot in there too, right? From what we covered earlier that you just kind of have to pull together. No burning questions? Yes.
This one says calcitonin helps mobilize calcium out of the bone and keep calcium high in the blood. I found somewhere it was false, but I thought it was true.
So calcitonin, parathyroid hormone. There's some little differences in some textbooks depending on a comparative aspect. So how to remember this? Anybody remember my craziness? I'm trying to give you crazy things so you won't forget. Calcitonin, tone in the bone, right? So calcitonin will get calcium into the bone to help build up bone. And parathyroid breaks it down and increases calcium in the blood. All right, does that answer that?
Okay, so it's false because it's in the bone, not out of the bone.
Yes, so calcitonin, if you increase calcitonin, so sometimes people take calcitonin to try to help build bone. And there was actually a legal dispute because one pharmaceutical company was selling that a number of years back to help with people with osteoporosis and things. And that company, you might have heard about those recent things with some of the other drugs, for the AIDS drugs and things. Mm-hmm. But that company actually said they were going to quit making it because they weren't making enough money. And then these people needed it for life issues as well. It actually went to Congress at one time to then get them supplemental money to keep it being made. So these pharmaceutical companies actually use people's lives as scapegoats to do things in their multi-billion dollar industries. But anyways, that's an interesting one too in history. So by knowing these things, it does have an impact sometimes in, you know, politics too and what you vote on. So you really want to kind of know this, some of these things. So good. So those hormones, try to remember some of those corny things, usually yin-yang aspects, right, with lots of these hormones. What else does parathyroid hormone do besides just maybe help in breaking down some bone, because they can activate osteoblasts, build up bone, osteoclasts, tear down bone. So osteoclasts that are activated by parathyroid hormone to increase blood calcium, but how else could you increase blood calcium? What else does parathyroid hormone work on to increase blood calcium? Where do you get your calcium? From the air? No. From food. Where does that food go to? In your GI tract. So it helps to get the calcium from your GI tract too. So it can work on your GI tract to help with calcium reabsorption or absorption. When we talk about the GI tract, we have to talk about absorption mostly. And then when we talk about the kidney, it's reabsorption, things like that. Okay. Other questions? Questions? Everybody's quiet over here. Are we okay? I'm just freaking out. Okay. Questions? Did we get a chance to look at old exams yet? Some of those have answers. Some of them might be marked on, you know, other people's stuff that you might have, and they might have marked them wrong, or sometimes there might have been confusion, and we might have changed some of those questions up because it wasn't really clear or something. You know, maybe the wording wasn't great. So kind of go through those, but I would hide your answers when you go through those tests. I would hide your answers and just read the question and see what you know from the question itself, right? And then try to answer the question your own way, or just change the wording up in that question and see if what you would know from it, right? You should rotate questions. Other questions?
I actually do have one.
Okay, good.
So it's talking about the renin, and it says, what is the direct function? And is that the same as...
Okay.
Like, is one the same as just antisynergen?
No. So angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, that was the angiotensin converting factor that converts. The main point that we're going to go back to that when we get to renal, but the angiotensin 2 is the one that causes vasoconstriction.
Right.
And so which is the direct function of renin? Yeah, we wouldn't have that on this test right now.
Okay.
Okay. That will come on the... when we get to the renal, more or less. Okay, because I'm trying to save some of those for the renal aspect. But do look through the final exams, too. Remember, even on the website, we have questions old exams. I think one of them is kind of weird. But one of them, like the final, was the same final from the other year, summer. But those summer exams are on your webpage, right? Those kind of help too. But they're more open response questions.
So on the website, there's like, I saw for like 2006 and 2009, there was like four exams. So mm-hmm. would it be more exam two or more exam three?
Well, it, yeah, that year kind of went crazy. Oh, yeah, we got some other things, too. That year, those summers, I would just look through them and download them and just kind of go through it because it shifts.
Like
those years,
three.
We had four exams,
okay.
But the finals have kind of reviews. Oh, I didn't mention this, but this kind of site is pretty neat, too. If you go on to this, you could just type EKG. It's really quite cool because you see a lot of these EKG traces, and they explain things a little bit differently. There you go. It explains things a little bit differently, too. That's kind of fun. I think some of this we didn't talk about, but it's neat when you talk about the EKG. We're not going to come back to it, but this ST segment, if it's high, they call it a STEMI, they can usually tell you had a myocardial infarction just by looking at the EKG. It's really quite cool. That you might have had, that this would be STEMI. It's a raised ST segment, so it goes up like that and it comes back. Sometimes you get an inverted T wave. That's pretty neat. That could be due to different aspects, too. That usually is if you're taking a drug, so like digoxin, that controls your heart. People have to monitor that level. It's for your contractility of your heart. And the aspects might be actually changed, the way that this shapes the ST segment. There's lots of interesting things. So just look at like EKG stuff and, look at that. It's pretty cool. Here's a probably, which one's this? This is probably maybe myocarditis or something. Other conditions that happen, pericarditis, how that could change stuff if you have inflammation. Really neat things, EKG stuff. It's really quite cool. STEMI. That's what we meant by STEMI, where you get a raised T segment, and means probably a myocardial infarction. There's something here that's really quite interesting, where the T wave goes the opposite direction too. That could actually be a traumatic brain injury can cause this too. So it's kind of interesting on an EKG. Lots of different things. Isn't that cool? Cool stuff. Anyways, so on the website, I don't know what's on there. This thing takes so long to go open. Right here are these tests, right? Summer exams. If you haven't looked at them yet, might be good too. I don't know what we'll do. We'll just kind of look over old exams and take questions here and there, maybe, right? Maybe work some of them up different. I'll probably spend Wednesday night doing that and then printing sometime, hopefully before the class. So some short answers, mostly multiple choice because we've got to finish it in an hour and 15 minutes. All right? I don't know what else to do in the sense of, do you want to go over anything else? Any chapters? You want to spend your time studying? Go to the library? Utilize your time well for the next couple days, right? Are we good? I don't want to hold you unless you want, questions and stuff. But, if you have a question at last minute and you email, I can try to answer it, but not just what's the answer for that question, but, maybe why that might be the answer. Is that cool?